Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Question: where are all the women artists? Answer: good question. For millennia, women were the subjects, not the makers of art, even though there were and are legions of brilliantly creative female artists. The stories of seven of these women, four born before 1910, the others between 1936 and 1946, form the basis of the book Identity Unknown, Rediscovering Seven American Women Artists. The woman responsible for sharing their stories is Donna Seaman, my guest today. An award-winning writer, Donna is editor of adult books at Booklist and has written numerous art book reviews. She grew up watching a woman artist at work. Her mother, a painter, started an artist's co-op, and the family home served as a gallery. Donna went to art school instead of college and spent years as a sculptor and painter, but in her words, knew in my heart that reading and writing were more truly my calling. Identity Unknown unites both of her passions, art and literature. Donna is also a member of the Advisory Council for the American Writers Museum, a recipient of the James Friend Memorial Award for Literary Criticism and the Studs Terkel Humanities Service Award. Donna's written reviews for the Chicago Tribune and LA Times, among others, as well as biocritical essays for the Oxford Encyclopedia of American Literature and American Writers. Her interviews with authors are collected in Writers on the Air, Conversations About Books. Donna, welcome and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Sandy. I'm thrilled.
Was it always obvious to you that female artists were marginalized?
Yes, indeed. I watched my mother try to balance the demands of family life, which she took very seriously, and her need to create. I also, from a very young age, was lucky enough to be brought to museums, and I did not see many women's names on the walls. I saw women portrayed in paintings and sculptures, often naked, which for a little girl is always startling. But I didn't notice very many women artists, and I was very aware of that.
Just as an aside, I interviewed the director of the National Museum of Women in the Arts in Washington, D.C., and I believe the statistic was 6% of works exhibited are done by females.
Still.
Yeah,
I mean,
yes. No,
amazing.
We're talking, yes,
now.
Exactly. Now,
yeah.
Not when you
not
were
when
embarrassed to see naked women in museums.
It's astonishing.
Did your mother talk to you about this?
Yes, we talked about a lot of things. I think both my parents were born feminists. I had a sister. There were two girls in the family. And it was always part of our family discussion that girls and women can do anything they want to if they put their mind to it and work hard. And my mother was very aware of that from her childhood, that women were treated as second-class citizens. And we were all very rebellious about this kind of thing, you know, right from the start, including religion and school and all of that.
As a painter, did she expect to sell her work, or was this a hobby, a labor of love?
I think my mother always hoped to sell her work. She certainly wanted her work to be seen, and still does, and made friends in the artistic community, which is how the co-op came about. Where I grew up in Poughkeepsie, New York, there were very few venues for art made by anyone.
Period.
Yeah,
yes.
Period. Mm-hmm. So they were very innovative. I mean, this was, you know, the kind of co-op years, commune years.
Right.
People got together to create their own space and make their own opportunities. So sales were nice, but I think being seen was just much more important, and being able to share work with others who were working to get to know other artists.
How did that feed into you as an artist?
I just felt that making things, that living with art was a natural way to be for us.
That doesn't mean you're talented.
Not at all. And I don't know that I am, but I needed also to make things. You know, just that idea of being kind of responding actively to the world. I always wrote as a little girl. As soon as I got my first camera, I was an avid photographer. Drawing. I got really interested in textile arts just kind of by chance, because the school I was attending, we had a wonderful crafts program. And, you know, it was more like, how do you spend your time?
Mm-hmm.
And I found that making things and thinking about art and looking at art was just deeply satisfying and meaningful to me.
But at some point, something went off in your head where you said, while I get tremendous pleasure and enjoyment from this, I want to earn a living doing something else.
Well, I want to earn a living.
Right? That was for you to say, not me.
You know, this is where you kind of separate yourself from artists. I'm just a terribly practical person. And I found it very difficult as a, you know, somewhat penniless art student to acquire the materials I needed, the space. I didn't have a car. You know, there's only so much you can carry on your bicycle. And I found that distracting. Whereas writing is, you know, sort of the most democratic of arts. You don't need very much to write. You know, a pen and a paper, a crummy little little typewriter back in the pre-computer days. I mean, I loved painting. I loved being in the studio. I was very close to many artists for many years and still am. But my language skills were just stronger. Mm-hmm. And when I look for work, another thing I did in terms of a living, I never had a very clear career idea.
Path.
What my path was staying with books. Reading was so important, has always been part of my life.
And fiction very important and nonfiction?
Fiction and nonfiction, poetry, all kinds of books. From a very early age, that was my big devotion. And so when I, you know, was looking for work, I kind of followed books. I worked in bookstores. I worked in libraries. I worked in, and I felt that publishing was a good place for me to go because it brings together some art, visual art side.
But when you got into publishing, did you ever hope that you would be publishing you?
I did want to write. I very much wanted to write. And I was very lucky in finding my way to the American Library Association, which has a large publishing department. It's a membership organization for librarians. And mm-hmm. the publishing arm is, you know, makes some of the money to support
sure.
this good cause. That's always been very important to me, too, in terms of career. I always felt that I needed to work for a place that had a mission that did some public good. I was just not a commercial person.
And you did?
Yes.
So your first really satisfying job was?
The first library I worked in. Mm-hmm. I loved working in libraries and being around books and scholars. And I just found it endlessly exciting. And, you know, your imagination is fed so much. I worked in this Linda Hall Library in Kansas City, Missouri, which is a private science library. I couldn't believe the things I was seeing there. It was so inspiring. I worked at the Newberry Library in Chicago, a famous research library with phenomenal collections. This just, you know, was so exciting to me and certainly inspired art and writing for me. So.
And you had a special relationship, didn't you, with the great Studs Terkel?
I did know Studs. He was such
because you wound up somehow in Chicago.
I did wind up in Chicago, kind of heading east and got waylaid. I never imagined I would live in Chicago, but there were a lot of people I knew there from art school. The School of the Art Institute of Chicago is a fantastic place.
And that's where you went?
No, I never attended there.
Oh, okay.
I went and got my English degree. But I had a lot of friends and connection to the school. Tremendous museum. Chicago's a little easier to manage as a student than New York City. And just one opportunity after another opened up for me. And as you do, I love radio. And I worked in university libraries, staying with the books, met many creative people, including a friend of mine who was working at Loyola University's radio station, WLUW. He was a real innovator, Craig Coyce is his name, in community programming. And so I just suggested a book show, and we did one. And it was called Open Books, and I was on the air for many years, and it began sort of as a reviewing venue. I would talk about books I was reading.
Uh-huh.
Then I started hearing from publishers, do you want to interview authors?
I'm sure, like, a no-brainer. Yeah.
And that's around the time I met Studs, who, of course, was my great inspiration and mentor, Mr. Conversation
and
himself.
So more than just the interview, you two forged a relationship.
I was part of a circle that knew Studs and loved Studs, yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
One of my favorites, and yes, we ran into each other a lot. He was a completely amazing man. Even after he lost his hearing, he could conduct full conversations, even over the phone if he knew you. He had some extrasensory senses, for sure. One of my favorite memories about Studs was I was on the board of the National Book Critics Circle, and they do Lifetime Achievement Awards every year. And I was on that committee one year and had the great, thrilling privilege of awarding it to Studs Terkel.
Oh, that's wow.
I'll never forget being on a stage with him. The audience clapping was percussive. I thought we were going to get pushed back against the wall. It was so intense.
And oh, what a magical moment.
It was.
And
truly.
We'll stay with you forever,
forever,
obviously.
Forever.
And so basically, your job as editor of adult books at Booklist, was that your dream job?
Well, yes. You know, it's so funny that you use that term. Many people use that term. I came to ALA and worked I was like an editorial assistant in their book department. And Booklist, which has been around for over 100 years, which is one of the pre-publication review journals that librarians and others
go to
depend
mm-hmm.
on. Yes. Booklist uses many freelance reviewers, including lots of ALA staff. Mm-hmm. So I started writing for them, you know, as soon as I could as a freelance reviewer. And then when an editor left, I was able to move to staff. And I just became editor of this section a little over a year ago, but I was in that department for quite a long time.
Is that how you started out, writing reviews for art books? Or was it very eclectic?
It was very eclectic. I think some of my first books were novels, but I did, of course, tell my editor that I had an arts background, so mm-hmm. immediately I did start reviewing that. I'm a huge fan of biography mm-hmm. also.
Me too.
Are you too? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I am. So why don't you now take us on this identity unknown journey? I'll just throw a bunch of questions at you. And how did you select the seven women? What do they all have in common? Why did you write this book?
This book has been on my mind for a long, long time. The impetus initially was my great passion for Louise Nevelson, the great sculptor who was a superstar when I was a girl and a student. A big inspiration to me. I loved her work so much. I can't remember exactly when I first saw it. I'm sure it was at the Modern Museum of Art in New York. And it just made perfect sense to me, always. And I've, you know, followed her life. I saw her work all over the place. And then suddenly, in the 90s, it seemed to just, poof, vanish. And because I review so many art books and spend so much of my life in museums and libraries, I had this habit of looking in indexes of art history books, and she wasn't there. I found this appalling and mysterious.
A real sin of omission, huh?
Oh, yes. And so that kind of started me thinking about women artists, and it seemed like, and I say this in the book too, it seemed like the only woman artist people could name, well, there were two, Georgia O'Keeffe
right.
and Frida Kahlo.
And Mary Cassatt.
Yes, and Mary Cassatt. Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
It was that trinity.
And I knew that was ridiculous, that was crazy. And that an artist of Nevelson's stature and influence and innovation could be so quickly forgotten.
And disappear.
Disappeared. I mean, I figured she'd come back at some point, but I wanted to write about her and about that and about the whole question of women artists and their image. You know, I kept thinking about the mythology that grows up around male painters, like Jackson Pollock is the big example. You know, he's this sort of hero, this wounded hero that dies tragically, and, you know, the heavy drinking, the working out of it, tearing his soul open. Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. And then we have Georgia O'Keeffe, you know, if we just look at American artists, who, you know, started out with, in Alfred Stieglitz's photographs, as this erotic beauty, this mysterious, highly sexualized woman whose work was always interpreted sexually, whether she meant
yes, or not.
Then she heads out to the desert alone and becomes almost like a nun, mm-hmm. a nun artist. And I thought, so this is, you know, this is cynical of me, perhaps, but I felt, so this is the kind of woman artist we want. She's went through her young, sexy time. Now she's clean as a whistle and pure and out in the desert, and we like that.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
women artists that are living, you know, like a more ordinary or very messy, difficult life, that have children or marriages or have to work, that's not good. You know, we don't want that. That's too real.
That image is not what we're interested
exactly.
in.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's
so
complicated.
True.
Yeah.
Ironically, though, there are American artists, Helen Frankenthaler,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, or Maya Lin in terms of sculpture, or Judy Chicago, Lee Krasner,
Lee Krasner.
But we're digressing. So where's Louise Nevelson? You don't know. She just kind of fell off the canvas, so to speak. So then what happens to you?
So I decide I want to write about this, and that was the first essay
when
I wrote.
When was this?
It was like 10 years ago.
Okay.
That was an early piece. And there was one biography that had been written about Louise Nevelson. Another just came out. That's how many years it took. And that was 27 years ago, I think, that first book came out. And so when I started thinking about Nevelson, and then I started thinking about other artists and the seven in here are artists whose work I came across one way or another and just—
Happenstance.
But happenstance in a way that I'm always looking.
Okay.
That
yeah.
I'm always mm-hmm. open to it, that mm-hmm. I'm always going to museums, that I'm always looking at books. But just work that really struck me, and also realizing that if I hadn't heard of this artist before, many people
Duh.
Would not.
Yes.
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Even mm-hmm. though they were famous. All these seven achieved fame, even if it was more regional than national, but some internationally famous. And like Nevelson, it was just this cutoff point mm-hmm. after they died. That was it. And it seemed that their stories were really important to tell. And the more I learned about them, the more intrigued I got at how, you know, devoted they were to their work, no matter what was going on or no matter what the response or no response was.
But still, seven, and there could be 70, 700,
easily.
Whatever. Is there a common thread among these women?
You know, one simple criteria I chose was I decided to write about artists that were modern artists.
20th century.
20th century, mid-20th century, and that we're no longer living, because I just
okay.
wanted to kind of look to the past. There's many living artists I would love to portray in living profiles, but I decided in the book that they would be gone. And I think, you know, the common thread to me was the incredible freedom they secured for themselves to make art in spite of many other obligations and concerns, adversity and hardship, that they stayed true to their need to make art and changed their art according to their own interests and feelings. Like, you know, it's a very temptation if you succeed at some point. I'm thinking of Joan Brown, for instance, who she was as successful as an art student in San Francisco. She was showing when she was like 22, these very expressionistic paintings. They were just thick, thick impasto, so much paint on there. Like, there's a story I tell where she was so impatient with her work that she would hang it before her paintings were dried and the paint would slide off,
drip down
on the floor. And she had great success with these. And she had a gallery in New York and a gallery in San Francisco. She did that for a while. And then she thought, I'm finished with this. I want to do something different. And her handlers and everyone, they were appalled. And she said, this is not why I make art, to make money for you.
So she had a successful career.
Very successful. Mm-hmm.
For a woman
mm-hmm. and a young woman mm-hmm. In a very male time, in a very male way of painting, a mm-hmm. sort of action painting, expressionistic. She didn't have a full-time job, but she was teaching. She had a child. She was married. She was married several different times. But she felt she needed to do something different in her work, and she did. And she was criticized for it. Galleries didn't want to show new work. But it endures, and when you look at it now, you're like, of course.
Does that surprise you that she's not a household name?
Now, of course, in the Bay Area, you might find more people that remember her.
Okay.
She ended up, as Louise Nevelson did, too, in making large outdoor public sculptures.
So, uh-huh.
But in the Bay Area, she did one in Texas that's still there, in a shopping mall, actually. She went from doing really personal studio work, a lot of self-portraits. She kind of told her story in images, as another artist in my book, Gertrude Abercrombie, also did, which is kind of a radical thing, saying that a woman's life is a subject for paintings. In Joan Brown's case, she painted her husband, her child, their dogs, mm-hmm. their dishes stacked in the sink.
Was she a realist?
She was a figurative artist, yes.
Uh-huh.
And a very expressive, and used herself as a subject a lot throughout her
life. Self-portraits?
Self-portraits, mm-hmm. many self-portraits. She became very spiritual as her life went on. And so her paintings sort of went from this very artistic and expressionistic and kind of classic portraits and landscapes to more and more symbolic works that traced her spiritual path and adopted the religious sort of symbols. And, the critics just hated these works. They were so harsh to her.
So does that mean that they weren't exhibited? That she didn't get?
She had shows.
She did.
She did.
In museums?
In museums and galleries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so at different points, different people loved different aspects of her work. Mm-hmm. But she had things to say. I so admire that.
So what are like kind of the generic ties that bind these very different seven women? And what made you pick these seven?
Well, partly it's just a matter of taste. I mean, I looked at Joan Brown's work and said, yes, I really want to know more about this artist. Lois Mailou Jones, I was in the Milwaukee Art Museum and saw an early painting of hers that was kind of Art Deco, a little kind of Egyptian. And I'm like, who is this? This is a fantastic painting. I came across a book, the one book about her, and she, like Joan Brown, constantly reinvented herself. She started out painting very impressionistic works. She was African American. She went to Paris. She taught at Howard University, traveled all over Africa and Haiti, and in each culture absorbed visual styles and patterns and colors. And her work is just this incredibly global synthesis of influences. So that really impressed me. I guess I'm just, you know, interested in very dynamic creativity. And so she had that.
Did all of these women experience, and I use this in a positive way, notoriety in their lifetimes?
Good question. I was very struck by how careful Lois Mailou Jones was about avoiding any notoriety. She was a consummate professional. I say in the book that I think she scrubbed her personal files as though she was like a CIA operative or something. And I think there's two reasons for that. I think one, that women are held to such high standards, and people are always looking for weakness and looking for some scandal. Also, I think being a woman of color, she had a double burden.
No kidding.
And it's really interesting. She would talk about this, and she found it increasingly frustrating over her long, immensely productive life to always be categorized as a black woman artist. And she would say, I am an artist.
I am an artist. It has nothing to do with my gender or my race.
And that was always how she was marked. So I think she went to great lengths to be perfect in her public persona.
Wow.
She always looked impeccable.
What a road to hoe.
Oh, absolutely. 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 On the other hand, the people that were somewhat notorious was Louise Nevelson,
sure,
who had a temper and was a real late bloomer. She was not recognized till she was in her 50s. She had a really hard time. She struggled with depression. She drank too much. She had a wild life, a very wild life, and was not ashamed of it at all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And more power to her.
Mm-hmm.
And dressed like a warrior goddess in her many layers and famous long false eyelashes and turbans. And she went for it. She was so fully alive, which I feel is part of the reason she was quickly dismissed.
Okay.
She was not a good, clean nun painter like Georgia O'Keeffe. She was a wild New York Jewish woman with a
right.
lot of attitude.
How long did this take you to compile? This must have been
years. I love the research. And
at some point, did you think, oh, maybe I should add this person?
Well, or
it's like having favorite children.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and I was so attached to each of these artists, it was painful for me to move on to the next one. I also, originally in the proposal for the book, I thought these profiles would be shorter and I would do more of them. But of course, I worked at Booklist the whole time I did this.
And how long did it take you to do?
You know, I had the contract a few years ago, but I had written a couple of them before, mm-hmm. and quite a while ago. We have a very rigid structure at the magazine that, you know, every word counts. You can't go over. You have to write tight, tight, tight. So I found once that I was out of my cage as a writer with this book.
Yes.
And I went crazy. Mm-hmm. I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So my wonderful editor, to whom I will be forever grateful to, said to me, all right. And I said, can I do less profiles and write longer because these stories have not been told this way? I was doing a lot of original research. I did interviews especially for the Christina Ramberg piece.
Mm-hmm.
Very little. She died young. You know, these artists fall into two categories, the ones that had long, good lives mm-hmm. and ones that died tragically very young or 50s. So, yes, we agree that 7 was a good number and that I could write a little longer.
If you could speak for these 7 women, did they die feeling good about themselves?
I think Lois died. I mean, she lived to be recognized and celebrated. So I think she died very proud.
Even though she took such pains not to get in your face, so to speak.
There's an amazing story about Lois where this was in the 40s. She, as an artist of color, could not enter certain juried exhibits in our nation's capital. And she had a very—
You expected that to get a rise out of me?
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think you and I know this, but I think a lot of younger artists would mm-hmm. probably be appalled, I hope. So, yes, in the Jim Crow era and pre-civil rights, you, as an artist, could not submit your work to national museums in Washington, D.C. So Lois, being a really smart person, had a very she made a very close friend when she was in Paris, a French woman named Celine, who came over here actually and got stuck here during World War II. She submitted work for her. Or Lois would just mail it in and not say anything about who she was. And she won prizes, and these works were accepted. And
that's great.
Before she died, the museum issued a public apology to her in writing.
How many years later?
Online. Ooh, like 40 years later.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
But answer that question in terms of,
I know
I'm glad we digress, but
yes.
Do you think that they—
I think all but Gertrude Abercrombie did die feeling that they had done what they wanted to do.
And why didn't she?
Gertrude, she was a very lonely, she got very depressed. She drank too much. She ruined her health. She became a recluse. She went from being sort of the queen of Bohemia in Chicago near the University of Chicago in the Chicago neighborhood of Hyde Park, a salon. She was also a musician. She played the piano. She was, another person that crossed lines. She had one of the first integrated arts salon in her brownstone on the south side of Chicago and was friends with jazz musicians like Sonny Rollins and Dizzy Gillespie.
Mm-hmm.
And Miles Davis came to her house. She knew Charlie Parker. She was just in the great ferment of that creative time when Chicago was really a center for black arts. And after that, things kind of went downhill for her. She married a very difficult man who I suspect was actually a horrible man and became very depressed and sad and had a lot of bad health problems and got very lonely. I will say, though, that before she died, she had a major retrospective of her work that she did attend the opening. She was in a wheelchair, but she was there. So I'm hoping that that was what she was thinking about.
Where are their works today?
They are around. Gertrude
Are they in any permanent collections?
They are in permanent collections. Whether they're on display or not is the trick.
Hello. Mm-hmm.
I saw a couple at the Pennsylvania Academy of Arts in Philadelphia, the Gertrude Abercrombie pieces, which I was thrilled to walk in and see them there. Christina Ramberg, you can see at the Art Institute of Chicago. I will say, interestingly enough, that over the years I worked on this, I was not the only one that was wondering what happened to Joan Brown and Christina Ramberg and Ree Morton, who we haven't talked about too much, a brilliant sculptor who died very young in Chicago. A great favorite of Marcia Tucker, who founded the New Museum here in New York. She was a student of Marcia's. While I've been doing this, other people have been interested. Works have come out of storage. Exhibits have been mounted, including in Europe. I found catalogs in Venice and in Berlin for some of these artists. Lenore Tawney's work, she's a fiber artist we haven't talked about too much. She, like Joan Brown, was a very spiritual artist. She had a good, long, long, productive life into her 90s. She was a remarkable person. Her work's showing up now. She knew Agnes Martin, and
there was a retrospective of hers at the Guggenheim that I saw. Yeah,
exactly.
Although she generates a lot of controversy.
Agnes Martin.
Yes.
Yes, yes. She's become a very well-known painter, of course.
But it took a long time.
It took a very long time. And because she and Lenore knew each other well in Côté Slip, in that community where a lot of artists on the waterfront worked in the, I guess, 60s, Lenore Tawney's coming back into the on the stage of art, and I'm starting to see exhibits of her work, too.
Do any of these artists have children who are pushing their work? Or?
They have great estates. Louise Nevelson's granddaughter I was in touch with. Christina Ramberg's son is very generous with their estate, very supportive. Joan Brown's son, the same. Lois Miley Jones did not have children, but she became very close friends with a doctor in Washington, D.C., who runs the trust, and Dr. Chapman, and he's doing a fantastic job. They've built a great website. I just saw an exhibit, just happened to see some paintings of Lois Miley Jones at the Atlanta airport a week or so ago.
Wow.
I was stopped in my tracks and thrilled to see this.
So what did this do for you? Because clearly, the research of this book, the writing of this book, the publishing of this book were all, I'm putting words in your mouth, amazingly seminal moments in your life.
Tremendously satisfying and exciting. I felt that I could bring my sort of zeal to
passion,
curiosity. I learned so much doing this. It's an illustrated book. Working with the photographs was a lot of extra work. It was really deeply satisfying to me because I love the images so much. You know, I love the whole production process, being in touch with museums and, you know, getting permission.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it put me in contact with a whole other facets of the art world that I had not been in contact with before. And I really enjoyed those exchanges, that feeling of telling stories that I feel are really important and that people will find inspiring and instructive and I hope exciting. So it brought together many things that I deeply care about and have been committed to for a long time. And it just brought it all together in a way that I'm really pleased
about. Do you think that as you look at your book and what you've done, that you are optimistic, for lack of a better word? Is something going to happen that hasn't happened before?
Absolutely.
That you don't have to be Judy Chicago?
Yay for Judy Chicago. What a warrior. I do. I feel very hopeful. I'm just amazed at what you can find online. I will say that for the visual arts, I think the whole digital world has been incredibly democratizing. I could not take time off. I had to do short research trips.
Mm-hmm.
But I could stay up late and go online.
I hear
and
you.
Find amazing sources. And I'm so grateful to this country's Smithsonian Institute, the Archives of American Art. You know, we don't praise ourselves enough for what we've done in this country to make education possible. Public sources are so underappreciated right now. It's just infuriating
to me. And the power
that
they have.
That they give. You know, the National Archives, all the Smithsonian collections, these are open to the public. They are free. They were assembled by people that believe in sharing information and public good.
Mm-hmm.
This is so important and makes it possible for scholars of all kinds. You know, you don't have to be in an Ivy League college. You can be a working person like myself and do serious research without having to spend money or, you know, get special permission.
Mm-hmm.
You could just be anyone can access these things. That was so important to me. And online, I see other people sharing these things. You know, on the Pinterest sites, I found all these artists. I found blogs that women are keeping about coming across artists. And I hope that, you know, people that find their way to Identity Unknown will also share it and be excited about it. A lot more women are writing about art. There's great women biographers writing about all kinds of creative people and journalists. So I feel things are a lot better. I feel that I'm kind of part of a group of people that are telling women's stories. And look at all the group women books that are out right now, The Hidden Figures.
Yes, yes, yes.
As an example, mm-hmm. Donna Sobel's book, The Glass Universe, was also about a bunch of women scientists working at the Harvard Harvard Observatory. There was a book called Rocket Girls. You know, I sort of feel like I came out from my writing cave and found myself in the company of amazing writers doing similar work about women's histories that have been overlooked. And, you know, I personally love those group biographies, the collective biographies. Like, here's a whole bunch of amazing people around
the same time. Yes, over here.
And you've never heard of them, but now I'm telling you these stories.
Well, that's how I feel about this program.
Yes.
I think this is the most perfect way to end. We're out of time. But to end on that upbeat note and that optimistic note, we need, you know, Donna Siemens to bring to light the other women who we don't know anything about.
Well, thank you,
Sandy. Keep doing what you're doing.
And the same to you.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.